We hope the new president will resuscitate the world. And you see, Hasidim, they're still davening. Ein malasot, ein malasot. Yutet Kislev, Yutet Kislev.
They wouldn't stop. They said
Tachanun. I tried to stop them in my minyan from saying Tachanun. I didn't succeed, but this much did happen, that after davening, Simcha Merdebra boat broke into Faratzta, and everyone was singing with Kavana. Wow, wow. We hope for the best. The day will come when it'll be all one. Anyway, we have another minute. There's another student, Jomo, whose name you hear all the time. I don't let him come on Monday morning. I send him to Shvatami. You know, has to go into the big world already. 35 years of age, he's Shin Sight. So I'm partially successful. Not that much I've accomplished. As far as finding a wife, I still get the same answer. If the Ribbono Shel Olam wants to send me a wife, I'll do my part. I tell them it's the opposite. You have to start looking and hope the Ribbono Shel Olam will help. But so far...
That's the story with the guy who drowned.
Yeah.
Who sent the submarine? Who sent
the... Baruch Hashem. Mazal tov, mazal tov. Oh, can I inherit? I also get a number of mazel tovs. I have this Thursday, we have, I don't know what to call it, Mike calls it a christening, where we were a welcome party for my new great-granddaughter, Shani Chana. And January 3rd, I'm being Masada Kedushin for my grandson, marrying a Shani. She's half from your city, estate. The father is from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and the mother got out of Persia, a little girl, minutes before the Shah fell. Or the mother's mother, in other words, his mother-in-law-to-be. So it's an interesting background, and Kanayin Hara, wonderful children. So Kanayin Hara, and I'm expecting a great-grandchild momentarily. So, Kanayin Hara, God should just give us health. The bad news is, as you grow older, I'm afraid to answer the telephone, and you can fill in the rest. I have to figure out today how to leave. I was on my way to my daughter yesterday, and I see a sign, Moshe Billig died. Moshe Billig, and yours truly, Malcolm, myself, Esther Billig, we go back to one of the few Frim families in Newark, New Jersey. Was a pharmacist, came in Aliyah right after we did. A whole little group from Jersey came and had a pharmacy here. His son took it over. Wonderful, wonderful people, a survivor. All right, we can begin. It's December 12th, 2016, Yudhet Kislev. And,
19th.
What did I say? December 19th. 2016, Yudhet Kislev. Thank you for straightening me out. Now, first of all, coming back on Yudhet Kislev, I spent 2.5 years on the Rebbe, so I cannot, I spoke yesterday, you know, in the Sunday class, I got involved with the Mumisara. So I've gotten so much material, I'll give it out later. Hundreds of people have blessed me for bringing her up again and reminding people that she lived, how many Jews she saved. I also, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in Yiddish, an aunt is a tanta. Mum is also an aunt, but in my family, the feeling I got was when my Zaydi used the word mumma, it was with awe. There was a mumasara in our family too. I'm named for her husband. And that was my grandfather's aunt, and the family stood in awe for her. So we never called the Tanta Sara, we called the Mumma Sara. So I hope I'm right, but that's the feeling I get with the use of Yiddish. Anyway, coming back to the Rebbe, my Talmud David Neumann, who by the way is interrelated with Vic Snow, who's from Florida now, sent me this. He told me that the descendants of Mumma Sara were actually eyewitness to this, or heard the story that there was a family in Cleveland, Ohio, and the kid was going with the Gaya. So Rabbi Karzin, who we spoke about, one of the children of Mumma Sara, trying to talk the kid out of going with the Goya, he got nowhere. The parents of the son went to see the Rebbe. The Rebbe said, ask your son to come see me. No, the son, the last thing in the world he wanted to do was go see Lubavitcher Rebbe, but what the heck, he went to see the Rebbe. So the Rebbe didn't try to talk him out of it. The Rebbe just said to him, you know, your parents are not pleased, they're marrying a Goya. You know, I give you some advice. The next time you see your fiance, ask her to pour you a glass of water. So the kid walks out, he figures, boy, this rabbi is cuckoo, and he goes back to Cleveland, and Itaker asks her, you know, can I have a glass of water? And she goes to the faucet, she turns it on full force, and she gets splashed. And she says, here, you damn kike, here's your glass of water. And when she called him a kike, he knew this was it, that his parents were right, that the Rebbe was right. What a story. And David Newman swears that this actually totally happened. Yitz Gold, who is an anagel of the Mumasara, sends this story that I've heard before. It's written up in one of the books that came out on the Rebbe's yard site. But in what went on in France, the Jews running away who come to France, and children without parents, and the Jews take them into an orphanage. And this is 1940, 1941, and these kids, there's no food, the Germans have come in, what's going on? And one man would come by the orphanage every evening and bring rolls and food for the children, and literally, for these kids. And they didn't know his name, they only knew him as Mansour, you know, Mister, if I'm pronouncing it right in French. And he would come every day, and then he went on, they heard he left the country, but he was there at a period where he literally sustained them. So this person, Rabbi Aaron David Newman, later gets to America and goes to see the Rebbe. And he comes in to see the Rebbe, and the Rebbe looks at him, and the Rebbe calls him by his name. And kid stares at the Rebbe, and he realizes that was the Mansour. That was the man. Big skuyat. Okay. Back to Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner. So as I said, what we're going to do with Rabbi Kuttner, Be'ezrat HaRetzion of Koach, we described his life last time, a very fascinating life, because he goes one country to another country to another country, and in each place he picks on a new tinge, a new layer. We left off, we spoke at the end of the class, 1970, the hijacking of the plane, and Rav Yitzchak Kuttner caught up in the hijacking, winds up in Jordan, winds up in the desert, and thank God with miracles, they're able to save him. The last decade of his life was very difficult. I alluded to it, but I got to drop more information because Morty asked me a question at the end of Shir, where did he die? The last decade of his life, his heart was in Yerushalayim. He felt his end might be near after the kidnapping, growing older, moving on in years, and he desperately wanted to build a branch of Chaim Berlin in Yerushalayim. That last decade, he kept on going back and forth. His daughter, and I'm now quoting from the book I mentioned to you, the Sefer Zikaron, Lamaron Baal Pachad Yitzchak, his daughter writes that 1980, the students in America pleaded with him, come back for Chodesh Elul, for Chodesh Tishrei. Rav Kuttner came back, but he didn't feel well. And Chol HaMoed Sukkos, his minhag was, his nohag was, that every night he had a fabrengen in his sukkah. That year, he couldn't do it. He didn't feel that well. Shmini Atzeret, they still had a mesibah. And then he went back to Israel, and he had a stroke. Stroke was in Chodesh Marcheshvan. and he was sinking. And here she writes about her father's sense of humor, that in bed they propped him up and they put a pillow and they asked him, is the Rosh Yeshiva bakempt? Meaning, are you comfortable? Are you comfortable? And the Rosh Yeshiva says, Zei fregen mir, ich bin Noach. They're asking me if I'm up the Pashat Noach, if I'm comfortable. Und ich halt schon beim Lech Lecha. And I hold by going away. So you see, he knew already the sense of humor. What's amazing is, and here I had to call and apologize to someone, and I'll tell you in a second, he died on Beit Kislev, buried in Chalkat Neviim Har HaZeitim, which I mentioned last week, that he's buried here, he died here, he evidently left the will to be buried in Har HaZeitim, Chalkat HaNeviim, not to be buried where many other Rosh Yeshiva buried on Har Menuchat and the Chalkat Rabbanim, and I can understand why, as we'll see later today, or in the next few weeks. What's amazing about Bet Kislev, and this is very powerful, just think for a minute, Bet Kislev is the yard site of the first great Rosh Yeshiva to build Torah in America, Rabbi Revel, Beit Kislev, my cousin. Beit Kislev is the yard site, you might say, the second greatest builder of Torah in America, not the pioneer, but years later, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Beit Kislev. Beit Kislev is the yard site of the most beloved Rebbe there ever was in Yeshiva University, Yeshivas Chochanan, Rabbi Moshe Aaron Peleyev. Those of you who studied in YU may remember the name. It's before your time, I imagine. I still was privileged to know Rabbi Moshe Aaron. Rabbi Moshe Aaron Peleyev, very fascinating and innovating individuals. And Alta Slutska, big Talmud Chacham, came to America and went into business. His wife was more real. You have to make money, you have to make a living, America. And he went bankrupt. So Rabbi Revel brought him into the yeshiva, and there he found himself as a Rebbe. He had a very unique system. 4 days a week he gave a simple shiur like a melamed. Gemara, Rashi, Tosfot. Gemara, Rashi, Tosfot. Thursday he gave a pilpul. And that already was with Rishonim and Rambam and Insight and all his sfarim that were later published are based upon the Thursday Shiurim. So that it seems that Beit Kislev is a date for Mabitzei Torah to be called on high. Why did I say I have to apologize? I was sitting at a wedding 2 weeks ago. And I'm sitting with an old friend, the Talmud of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. And we were talking about Beit Kislev. And he says to me, we were talking about the yard site, and he says to me, Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner's yard site. And I said, oh, no, you mean Rabbi Aaron Cutler. And then when I saw this, I saw he's right, that we were both right. Of course, I'm right about Rabbi Aaron Cutler. But Beit Kislev is also Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner. Now, I want to go a little bit further. As I told you, what I'm going to do here, I'm going giving a biography. People don't know who Rav Whitman was. And then we're going to zero in on his life piece by piece. And I want to go back to the biography and discuss a little bit what we spoke about, what we didn't fill in last week. All right, how did Rav Whitman become famous? And here too, very fascinating. He was a kid, he was a Litvisher. He was a Slobodka. The first layer in him, and there are many layers to come, is the layer of the Litvisher Welt. As I mentioned, we had Yichus, both Hasidish and Litvish. While yet a teenager, he published a sefer that shook up the world, Torat HaNaziah, on Hilchot Naziah. The Sefer showed him to be a top Talmud Chacham. And I need not tell you, in the literature well, this is the way you make your reputation. What's amazing is the Sefer came out with three Haskamot, and this was a kid, he was 17, 18. One Haskamah was from the leading Litvish Rav in Eastern Europe, Rav Chaim Moshe Grishinsky. A second Haskamah was from the chief rabbi of Palestine, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Chag Sameach, Chag Sameach. You missed what I accomplished in Shul today. They did say Tachnun, but at the end of davening, they sang Uforatzta. And everyone joined in, even the people who insisted that we can't skip Tachnun. In my minion, I'm a youngster. These other guys there, you know, Yerushalmiyim Dorei Dora, Simcha Mandelbaum, how many generations? You know what they say about Simcha Mandelbaum? He's related to one half of the state of Israel. And the other half he's probably related to, but he doesn't want to admit it for many reasons. Back here. The second Haskamah, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. The third Haskamah was the person who gave the Rav Smicha, Rav Avraham Dovber Kahana Shapira, the Dva Avraham, the Covenant Rav, the last Covenant Rav before the Holocaust. You don't know who the Dva Avraham was. Again, you know, time marches on. The Dva Avraham, when his Sefer came out, Dva Avraham Chelek Aleph, he was a Velazhina, it was considered absolute golden lamdanut. The Rav, great admiration for the Dva Avraham. And he's the one who wrote about the Rav that the genes of Rav Chaim rest upon his grandson, Rav Yosef Dov. I translate it, I write it up in English in my work on the Rav. But Dva Avraham had another part of his personality which I can tell you I got hit over the head on, because I did a monograph on the Dva Avraham many decades ago. It appeared in Jewish Life, it was called. I republished it in Rakafet Aram, Chelek Aleph. And you can't believe the letters that came into Jewish Life that the Dva Avraham was a maskil, and he's not part of our world anymore. And then I did more research, and I found out he had a very positive attitude towards science, scholarship, going to university. His own son became a medical doctor. There was something of the Rav in the Dva Avraham. But I was amazed, one letter came, I know from whom, he worked for Feldheim, he was a Litvisha, and he said, no, he didn't like the yeshiva. I mean, he wrote about the Dva Avraham, he didn't, because he was too open, he might have wanted some secular study in the yeshivas, but very fascinating, interesting personality. What remains of him is very little. It was that one son who came to America, the rest of his children were wiped out, and that son was Zeicher, that from the family, there were a lot that came back to Yiddishkeit, Lev v'Nefesh. They weren't entirely wiped away by the United States. But could you imagine coming out with a Sefer that you had Haskama from Reb Chaim Moshe Grishinsky, the Kovner Rav, and Chief Rabbi Cook? Then something else happened in his life. Remember, he was in Berlin. We spoke about Berlin. Let me fill you in with the Rav, and then I'll come back to Rav Hutna. Those of us that attended the Rav Sheyurim, and you attended the Rav, and Yitzchak was in the Rav Sheyurim, we never saw a trace of Chachmat Yisrael in the Sheyurim in room 102. On Amsterdam Avenue. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah.
Where was the Chachmat Yisrael? If you didn't know what the Rebbe Binsky in life, he was just a Rosh Yeshiva like any other Rosh Yeshiva, right? He was more brilliant, he was more insightful. His mastery of Reb Chaim, obviously, the Briska Derech, I'm not here to, don't have to design my Rebbe for you, all of you know him. But there was never a trace of Chachmat Yisrael. Then when I did my research on the Rav, and I see he was in Berlin, and you open up his uncle Seifa Avodat HaMelech, Menachem Karakovsky, who was Dayan and the Magid Meisharim in Vilna, you open up Rabbi Menachem Karakovsky's Sefer, it, Lo Aleinu, most of it was lost in the Holocaust, but what was published in his lifetime, he died in 29, I believe. He died a young man. He published on Hilchot Mada and the first part of the Rambam he published on, Mada V'Yahava, I believe. And you open up the Sefer, there's Voloshin Alumdis there, but in addition, there's a feeling for scientific Jewish scholarship. And the Sefer is famous for that, that there was a bit of a synthesis of two different approaches. And in the Sefer, he quotes his nephew. Remember, the Sefer was published in 29, it was written in the 20s. My nephew, the young Gaon, Reb Yosef Dov, I asked him, look into the library in Berlin, check the manuscripts. And a number of times he quotes the Rav as giving him the reading, the variant readings in manuscripts of the Rambam and commentaries on the Rambam in Berlin. Wow. So, I apologize, but by 1983, I knew a little bit. You know a little bit, you become a chutzpah. When you know too much, you're not a chutzpah. Then you realize as much as you know, you don't know enough. But when you know a little bit, you think, wow, I'm rising. So I was a chutzpah, and I visited with Rebbe. It's the last time I saw Rebbe alive. I visited with him in YU. It was a very hard day for me because Rebbe had aged greatly and I don't want to describe, he could barely walk, he had to be held up, they were machaved me to walk on his right side, and I didn't realize that his gabayim had to walk with him, he couldn't walk without being held up. So anyway, we got to his apartment and he was good, his mind was good at that moment, and among the many questions I threw at Rebbe was, Rebbe, since when are you involved in Chachmat Yisrael? Your uncle quotes you. And the Rav's face lit up and said, you're right, he quotes me at least six times. I came and we discussed it, you know, the manuscripts. When I came back to the Kol, I had a student then, Yosef Chaim Klausner, known as Yedidja today. Harav Dr. Yosef Chaim Yedidja. Anyone know him? He lives in Efrat. Your Rabbi Rubin, character par excellence, says Rabbi Rubin will testify. So I knew who I could pick on. I said, Klaus, I need a little favor. I found four places where the Avodat HaMelech quotes Rebbe. Could you check it out? The Rav told me there's six places. Klausner gets back to me, there are eight places. And if you look in my work on the Rav, you'll see in a footnote, I give you exactly where he's quoted. But what does this show you? It shows you that in Berlin, there was this influence. Rabbi Chaim Heller was there, Rabbi Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg. I mean, these were people who were well involved in Chachmat Yisrael. So, Rabbi Hutna, when he's in Berlin, he is exposed to this as well. And his next work was a work where you absolutely see the influence of Chachmat Yisrael. Kovetz He'erot al Rabbeinu Hillel on the Sifrat was a Rishon's commentary on the Sifra, Midrashic Hablacha, Sefer Vamidbar, Sifra, and he edited the Perush, he did a super Perush, footnotes, cross-references. It's been reprinted a number of times. It was published already, Be'ilum Shem. First edition, Rabbi Hutner's name is not on it. Why Be'ilum Shem? You can only guess. I mean, Torah Tanaseh, he was known, but it could be, since there was some Chochmat Yisrael involved in the new edition, he decided didn't have to use his name. Published Be'ilum Shem. He began the work in Palestine, continued it in New York. That work was published, finished in New York. When it was republished, it's with his name. When the Torah Tanaseh was republished, it is a story unto itself. What do you do about the Haskamat? Because by this time, Rabbi Hutner had shifted gears. His students, those handling the publication, Rebbe, we should republish Rav Kook's Haskama? And it went back and forth. There's memoir literature on this. First he said yes, then he said no. You know what they finally did? Took out all the Haskama. Rav Hutner already by that time didn't need Haskamas. He was well known. Didn't want to only take out Rav Kook's Haskama because it's a real slap in the face from someone who taught him so much. So to solve the problem, mit dafnish kein Haskamas in Ganzen, and it was already at press, and they removed all three Haskamas when it was republished. Now, what makes Rav Hutner so difficult to understand, so difficult to comprehend, is the man was constantly changing. This was his personality. Is it good or bad to constantly change? It's an open question. I've spoken about this many, many times. The greatest compliment I get from students that I taught 61, 62, 59, 60, go back a few years. Some of them look older than I look. Some of them are not even around to talk. And they say, Rebbe, you haven't changed at all. And I have to tell you, a human being lives three periods in life. Again, I'm being mekatzer. You can check the medrash. But basically speaking, Shir HaShirim, Mishlei, Kohelet. We live three periods. I always say that an average human being can live three periods. All right. Morty is a scientist. Charlie is a scientist. All right, you're entitled in your youth. Shir HaShirim going to redo the hydrogen bomb. Right or wrong? Now, be honest, be honest. Don't play games with me. Charlie, biochemistry, well, what was your field when you left Harvard? Biochemistry, come on, cure the world. Then you come to Mishlei. Then Kohelet, all right. Chas v'chalila, Rebbe should have three periods, in my opinion. Because if you have three different periods, it means the students you raised in your youth are Naturakata. The students you raised in Mishlei are Agudat Yisrael. And the students you raised in your old age are Mizrachistim, or the opposite. So I dashen the Gemara, it's a Gemara in Chagiga and Moed Katan, it's twice in Shas. It's based upon a Pasuk in Malachi that you can only, the book that came out about Reb Moshe Tversky, an angel in our midst. You can only learn Torah from a Rebbe, ki Malach Hashem Tzfakat Shemo, im harav domeh l'malach, mat Torah mipiv. What does it mean, a Rebbe's a Malach? A Rebbe's a human being. No, he's like a Malach. Time has no imprint upon him. He's the same Rebbe, Shir HaShirim, Mishlei, Kohelet. He combines the three. One thing is certain, Rav Hutner did not combine the three. Very different than the Rav. The Rav, about all that changed, was his temper quieted down. Unfortunately, life taught him he's not. And the Rav said this himself, you know, he, and anyone close to the Rav, the people from Boston who knew the Rav intimately, they say, you know, before his illness, he thought, wow, what he demanded of students. And then slowly but surely, he made his peace with reality. That there he changed. He changed perhaps in another way that what he would speak about publicly in the 40s, he didn't want to speak about in the 70s, because he felt his Talmidim would consider him an Afikairis. It's not that his thinking changed, and you all know this is documented. Look into my the Rav, Volume 1, the footnote where I quote Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, the famous story with Reb Aaron and Rav Amital. Rav Amital comes to YU, and he's overwhelmed by the Rav, and they're waiting online, and the how the students relate to the Rav, and Rebbe says to Rav Amital, he says that you're right, they're giving up covered, you're right, and everything. And he says, I could wake them up in the middle of the night, and I'll say, I have a chiddush on the Rambam. And they'll all run to hear the shir, 4 a.m. in the morning. But when I want to talk hashkafa with them, they think I'm an apikairis. He says that to Rav Amital. You know, this is an eye-opener for Rav Amital. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein relates the story. So,
you're talking about his interest in philosophy.
But not only that. The Rav was not a kanoi. He had a certain openness that is, for instance, I don't believe Rav Meir Tversky has the openness of the Rav. You follow? And there was a breitkeit, a broadness. My classic example is, imagine if you came to the Rav, and this never happened, but it could have. Someone said, Rebbe, I'm interested in Chinese literature. The Rav would call him, get a doctorate, study it, see if there's anything you can compare to Talmudic, if there's any influence. You know, today, if you came to a Rosh Yeshiva, some of the Rosh Yeshiva in YU, and said, I'm interested in getting a doctorate in Chinese literature. It's too hard. What are you wasting your time? It'd take time away from learning. Get a simple doctorate. You got to make a living. It's good enough to be a lawyer, good enough to be a kveisa, an accountant. Well, Chinese literature. Now, the truth is, if you get a doctorate in Chinese literature, you have more time to learn than any other profession, because you become a professor. How many people know Chinese literature? So you understand, you give lectures 4 hours a week, you another 6-7 hours, you do some research, publish articles, you're a king. The guy who is a lawyer never has a free moment, and then he becomes the ambassador of America to the state of Israel. You follow? Baruch Hashem. So the Rav really remained the same Rav. But he once said that, give me a simple example, Rabbi Wurzberger did a doctorate at Harvard. And he did a doctorate on Jewish law and with philosophic overtones. And years later, he wanted to publish it. And the Rav, I can't quote word by word, but the idea of what the Rav said to him was, don't publish it, because in the 40s, our people could accept this. Today, they're going to criticize you. They're not willing to be this open. And Rabbi Wurzberger listened to the Rav, did not publish his doctorate, because the Rav told him not to publish it. Okay? Rabbi Hutna underwent many different changes. When he arrived in America, and this is amazing, I thank Chaim Schnitzer for sending it to me, there just was an auction of this picture in an auction house. The asking price was $200. It sold for $295. Here's the description. Here's the picture. Here's the picture blown up. And there is, these are five future world famous Rabbanim who are going to Slabodka, or they're in Slabodka. Look what they look like. And Rabbi Hutner is in the middle. Take a look of what he looks like. You can pass it around. You get the not only clean shaven, but a chup, what they used to call, when I learned in Lakewood, a chup. If he went to a Hasidic yeshiva, they'd throw him out head first with that type of head of hair. And look what they look like.
Who are the others?
The others, I'll tell you who. Your father-in-law would know them. Rabbi Dov Zachovsky, Rabbi Eliezer Goldschmidt, who I knew in Yerushalayim, was an Av Beit in here, Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner, Rabbi Moshe Tikhachinsky, Einik Lachia, very well known today, writing on Slabodka, Rabbi Zvulun Gras. I actually taught his daughters from Rehovot. That's correct. That is correct. And here they are, one with a bigger chip than the other, but the biggest chip is Reb Yitzchak Kutner. So you see, this is what he looked like. Came to America, clean shaven, short jacket. Within 1 year, he spoke a fluent English. Within 1 year, he could get up and teach in English without any hesitancy. And, you know, you got to give credit. All right, I have to say his wife was American, so he was exposed to English. His in-laws were American. I'm sure their native language was probably Yiddish, but they were totally home in English as well.
So he got married in America?
No, he got married in Warsaw. We spoke about it last week. He got married in Warsaw. That's before he goes to America. See, what we said last week is very important. He never had a monetary problem. His parents were well-to-do. He could do whatever he wanted. Lo aleinu, he never learned until 46 that they perished in the Holocaust. His in-laws were really well-to-do, so money was never an issue in his life. And this is an advantage or a disadvantage. You can take it either way. It's not a simple matter. My children my friends, we've debated this many times. I have one friend who is upset with me that I give everything away free. I should have an agent, and I'm the happiest person alive. People want to hear my shayurim. I remember when Nordlich was selling them, I they asked me, what do you get? I said, I get nothing. Nordlich claims it just covers his cost. I said, I'm the happiest person alive. No, you got to be a businessman. There are some rabbanim that turn their shurim into business. So, listen, bread and water I have. Children, if you give them too much, it's not good, because the kids don't want to strive. It's given to them, and I see that many, many times. So it's a mixed blessing. You can debate it from today to tomorrow. Obviously, there's no black and white answer. But Rav Kutner had the advantage. He never had to worry about money. Okay. This is the way he begins. Now, when you come to America, and we spoke about this in a different context years ago, I'll speak about it again, and down the line, I'm going to give you the sources for everything I'm saying. Come back to it in detail. When he came to America, he had a tremendous contact here, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, and I think we mentioned in Europe, when he came to Warsaw after being in Eretz Yisrael, the Soloveitchiks were in Warsaw, and when Reb Moshe went to America, finally got the visa to become the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas of Yitzchok Chanan YU today, he left his little son Aaron in Rav Hutner's hands. And Rav Hutner helped the boy, taught the boy, and ultimately bar mitzvahed the boy. It's all Rav Hutner. Rav Moshe was in America. The Soloveitchiks and Rav Hutner become very close at that time. When he comes to America, there is a letter that survives in the JTS archives. And remember, archives are very, very important, because you can't rewrite history when you go to an archive. When you read some of the art school books on history, and my critique is only on their books on history, and I've written many letters to them, and it hurts. Falschkeit. I don't believe you can build Yiddishkeit by lying. But okay, other Jews have a different opinion. So you can rewrite history. They find the letter in the archives of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik to the most famous professor at the seminary, a Gon Adir, a yeshiva boy in his youth, a Musanik in his youth. You all know the name, Levi Ginsberg, Louis Ginsburg. And in that letter, Reb Moshe, writing to Louis Ginsburg with such cover, we have a young man who just arrived from Europe, and I'd like you to meet with him. That's the letter we find in the archives, JTS. The letter has been reproduced, and if you don't believe it, it's photographed, it's in Reb Moshe's handwriting. It's absolutely authentic. And I'll give you sources for everything. And we don't know what happened. But see, it shows you, Reb Yitzchak Kuttner came to America, he didn't know which way he's going, what will be. It also shows you that JTS was still an institution that claimed fidelity to halacha.
What year is this?
Talking 34, 35. When I'll show you the letter, I'll get to it.
Where that's when he came to America?
Yeah. I told you last week, 34, 35. Remember, I told you last week the conflict of dates. I think he left Europe at the end of 34 and arrived in 35 because I saw a conflict. Wherever I turned, it's because it's Tatsah, and you don't know when Tatsah is. Like Tash Az now, it's 16 and it'll soon be 17. So it shows you the JTS, and if you've heard my Shagurim and I stand on it, and, I don't. Again, when you have theories, you have to say you're 90% right. Once in a while, I can say I'm 99% right. In my humble opinion, if the JTS did not have Mordechai Kaplan, why you and JTS would have combined in the late 20s? Read my chapter in Revel, and way beyond that, my postdoctoral research, where I really did a job. All archival work. It appeared first in Michael, Tel Aviv University, republished in, I think, volume 2 of Rakafet Aaron. It's a major work. That work was plagiarized from me. Someone, what's the difference? Forget it. I'm like, Giyaviyu Vatrin Haya. But that was a major work. But it was in a Favaf in a publication, Michael University, because they had came to me and asked me to work on this topic. And Mordechai Kaplan was the problem. You couldn't get rid of him, and you couldn't live with him. To get rid of him, he had too many followers who gave heavy money. Lamport family, just gave you one name. They gave money to JTS for Mordechai Kaplan. You couldn't get rid of him. On the other hand, Mordechai Kaplan, God was not a reality to him. Judaism as a civilization. You all know, I don't want to repeat my lectures now, but you all know Mordechai Kaplan, it was centered around the Jew as a unique civilization. It did not center around God and Torah and mitzvah and commandments. And the story with the umbrella, whether it really happened or not, we'll never know. But the anecdote, as the Rav said, they didn't tell anecdotes about Gedol. They didn't, when the Rav would talk about Gedol Yisrael, we don't always screw it up. But one thing I have to translate to English. I got complaints that last week I spoke Yiddish and didn't translate, and people are listening. Mit the Steiner and the Barbis, people don't know Yiddish. So one thing I can tell you, the Rav said, they won't tell stories like this about us. So this story is a Mordechai Kaplan story that eyewitnesses. Mordechai Kaplan himself told me. He lived around the corner from the old BMT. We knew each other. I gave him a lift once in my car. So Mordechai Kaplan told me he never carried on Shabbos. He tied together two handkerchiefs. Why? My father went like this. His father was a member of RJJ's for Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's Beis Din. Rabbi Israel Kaplan was a member of the Beis Din in the 1880s in America, New York. This is a Jewish civilization. On Shabbos, you tie the handkerchief around your neck. Okay, Mordechai Kaplan. No, then they see on a rainy Shabbos, he's going with an umbrella on the west side. It's before there was anything resembling an Erev. So a Jew says, Professor Kaplan, see Shabbos, it's Shabbos, how do you carry an umbrella? And Mordechai Kaplan answers, for a civilization, you don't risk your health. Quote, end quote. So you see, Mordechai Kaplan was the problem. But outside, yes, Helen.
You were speaking before about the various rabbis and how they changed, or they didn't change.
Right.
At that time, I was thinking about a story. I understand it's a true story about Mordechai Kaplan. He taught homiletics at the seminary.
Right.
And one week, he gives a sermon.
Right.
And then the next week, he gave a sermon. And the students came up and he says, "You completely changed what you said the week before.
Right.
Don't you remember what he says?" And his answer was, "I've grown since then."
I've grown since then. All right. Halavai, we should grow in learning. That we can accept. But Mordechai Kaplan, there's a different story. When his parents were alive, he was the English-speaking rabbi, Kilat Jeshua, and he was the assistant to Rabbi Moshe Zvulun Margolis. Later, Rabbi Ramaz's grandson-in-law succeeds Mordechai Kaplan, that's Joseph Fluckstein. So that then, when his parents died, he publishes an article, 1919 or so, that there was no Maimir HaSinai. Unbelievable. People said to him, "Is this what you really believe?" He said, "Yeah, I believe it all along." "Well, how come you never said it, never spoke, never alluded to the fact?" He said, "My parents were alive. Kibud Aviyem, I didn't want to hurt my father." That's a very powerful little story. But Mordechai Kaplan, there was no way, what will you do with him? Louis Ginsburg had moments in his life with biblical criticism, legends of the Jews, etc. He regretted it later in life. He also, but basically he remained a totally from Jew with a commitment to halacha. When you read the Shelet and Shuvit that my Talmud David Galinkin put together, you'll see there's not one Shuva there that I personally don't agree with the outcome. All right, with Sturgeon, there was a big machlokes in the time of the, you know, the Noda Behuda was matir. Then they claim, no, we changed. He never changed his mind. So I can't fault Mordechai Kaplan if he ate sturgeon on Friday night, all right? But he was, I can't fault the Louis Professor Ginsburg if he ate sturgeon on Friday night. But you see that even Reb Moshe Soloveitchik is willing to write a letter to JTS, to Professor Ginsburg, interview Rabbi Hutta. What happened, we do not know. What we do know is Rabbi Hutna becomes a Rebbe in RJJ, the high school. Now, RJJ was the second yeshiva in the United States, the first yeshiva at Seitz Chaim, 1886. 1886 morphs into what today is Yeshiva University. I just told a kid here in the Kollel about Tshuva. I don't know, he's overwhelmed, and like all the guys in the Kollel, Yitzhak, they did research, and the guys in the Kollel, they're just overwhelmed. They don't have time to listen to something beyond someone to help them understand the Daf Gemara and understand a few lines in Yeridaya. So I told them, I've been associated with YU since 1886. The guy absolutely thought I'm an idiot. You know, I've lost my mind. He didn't even start to understand what I'm saying to him. All right, I don't want to waste my breath. Let him master Shas and Paiskim, and in 49 years come back and study with me. Be'ezrat Hashem. But 1886, the second yeshiva formed as Eitz Chaim became more of an intermediate school than a high school, 1896. So the second yeshiva formed, 1897, I should say, because Reb Yitzchok died in 1896. The 97, they named it after him, and it began. So RJJ comes on the map as an elementary school. RJJ later adds on a high school. But there's no question that Reb Yitzchok Kutner felt very thwarted, that it wasn't for him. The challenge, the intellectual challenge, was not there. And then Reb Moshe Soloveitchik arranges for him to go to Chaim Berlin, which was an elementary school, and in Chaim Berlin, he should help organize a high school, and ultimately, not just the Matifta, but ultimately a Beit Medrash program. And that's where he shifts to in the mid-1930s, and that becomes his life. Misifta Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, is totally identified with Reb Yitzchak Chotner. Here too, you can see the gradual change in Rav Chotner. I give you a simple example, but a very powerful example. Mori Rebbe comes to YU 41, May of 1941, after Big Machloiket. Can he succeed his father? Can't he succeed his father? Remember, there was big controversy. It didn't happen overnight that the Rav came. The controversy centered around the Rav's reputation. He was in the rabbinate in Boston. He was involved with the Agudas HaRabbanim. He was involved with the Yudapayish Rabbanim. And students, many students, some students felt he's from the old generation. There's no modernity. The Elder Rabbanim will sell out Yiddishkeit. All the machloiket over Hechsherim. How many doctorates have been done? Corruption, fraud, kashrut, fraud, corruption, doctorate by Hal Gastworth. More doctorates have been done. They wanted no part of it. It was a big machloiket. Finally, the board of directors and part of the influence that brought it about was the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, who wrote a letter that the Rav must succeed his father, and they gave the Rav a one-year contract. And let's see what's going to happen a year from now, right? This is all documented. Rakefet documents it in his work on the Rav, the documentary that the Rakefet was privileged to bring into the world documents it. This is the Haperdes article documents it. I mean, it's fascinating. Sad what the Rav went through, but fascinating. So he comes into the yeshiva. The first year he gives is in Baba Batra. Otiyot Niknet B'Misir. Gary, you know what that's about? When you transfer a shtar, let's say you owe me $100,000 and I want to transfer to Alex, how do I transfer a shtar? Otiyot Niknet B'Misir, that obligation should pass to him from me. No, this is a yeshiva shashir, this is a Reb Chaim shir. For the next 44 years, the Rav said Sheurim, that was the mainstay of what he did at Yeshivas from his Hochanan. Nothing ever changed. Gemara, Shas, Paiskim, Reb Chaim. Yeah, once in a while, when he had energy, he taught in Bernard Rebel Graduate School and gave a sideshow in Jewish philosophy. But the Jewish philosophy was always the sideshow. In my time, in the 50s already, there was no sideshow. And I told you, Reb Chaim, his son, my classmate, Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, in the 70s, when Chaim, and I give him all the credit, Chaim went back to America. He was very well established here in Israel, professor at Hebrew U. And Chaim is Chaim, a genius of geniuses, Talmud Mufak of Professor Yaakov Katz, Jacob Katz. I knew Yaakov Katz intimately. I mean, he's with Gedoyle Mashe Ba'aretz, a little guy, Kol HaTorah Kula on his fingertips, and all of scientific Jewish scholarship, and you know, his work, his epic making on the Jew in the Enlightenment period. And he became the Rebbe for Chaim Soloveitchik, as far as what Chaim would later do in his own research, which I don't have to go further than Yeinam, which I told Chaim, I said, your work, Yeinam, is now the gold standard for Chochmat Yisrael. It's unbelievable. But with that type of mind, you should see what he produced. So Chaim got back to America to help take care of his father. He lived with his father in the YU dorm. He helped take care of his father. And he saw that his father was a little bit upset, what we alluded to before, that the students are moving so right-wing, and I have this in the Rav, where I quote the Rav word by word, where the Rav expresses these same thoughts in the Sheva Brachas, and many holes his home. Very powerful quote from the Rav, and people question, where did Rakefet get it? He had to make it, blah, blah, blah. So the tape was produced, and boy, oh, I I suddenly became a Rav Rakefet. He's an artist man. Oh, he quotes the Rav. Well, we might not agree, but that's what the Rav said. So Chaim saw that the Rav was upset, frustrated. He said, Tata, and by the way, they spoke only Yiddish to each other. The Rav spoke Yiddish with his children. They should know Yiddish. Chaim, Tata, Yizait Shuldik. It's your fault. So the Rav, Vasmeitin, what do you mean? What do you mean? You should give a course like you used to give in Bernard Revel. They wouldn't be so narrow-minded. And the Rav responded, he's like, you're right, but I don't have the strength. And see, that's part of old age. What I used to do as a kid, if I would tell you how many hours a week I taught, you would faint, you wouldn't believe me, but it's true. Today I teach 2 courses a week. And all week I have to pray for energies that I should be able to teach properly. But you see, the Rav, what did the Rav teach? Shas and Paiskam. Yeah, but he taught you, he taught, that was a sideshow. No one can disagree with my description. Not Rabbi Hutner. Rabbi Hutner began in Chaim Berlin, a regular Rebbe. 4-5 days a week, a shiur, shas, paiskim. As the years moved on, 1 day a week, shas and paiskim. But the big show of the week was his maimarim, his philosophy, his semantics, his homiletics, his maharal, his pachad Yitzchak. And this is a fact, can't be denied. There was a gradual shift. And ultimately, you see what's published from Rav Hutner, what is it, 8-9 volumes? Pachad Yitzchak. I've yet to see a volume. Yeah, in the final Sefer Zikaron, they put together some of his original Chidushei Torah from the 30s into the 40s. But the heart of Rav Hutner, you'll wake someone up in the middle of the night, you know that expression, the Rav taught it to us, in the middle of the night, your safety guards are down, your defensive mechanisms, so it's called Balabatish Seichel. You wake someone up in the middle of the night, no, what did Rav Hutner publish? Pachad Yitzchak. Pachad Yitzchak. I can tell you with the Rav, in 100 years from now, there will be 100 Svarim on his Chidushim to Shas, his Shayurim, 100 years from now. My only fear is that we won't have people who know Yiddish 100 years from now. I know what I'm saying, because
thousands of
Hasidim. Yeah, but the Satmar people are not going to publish the Rav. Maybe, I don't know. The Lubavitch, come on, how many Lubavitches know Yiddish? I was at the retreat, and some of these old-time Lubavitches with beards down to their shoelaces said to me, wow, you know Yiddish. They knew a little, they could understand the Rebbe, but they couldn't speak it. I spoke a little Yiddish with them. Wow, they sounded like an Israeli speaking English the first time. You follow? So that's the only problem that haunts me, because the heart of the Shayurim, the greatness, were in Yiddish. Although I have to say, from 1960 on, the classroom turned to English, so there is a world of material in English. The Saturday night shiurim in Boston shifted, when, in the mid-50s, late 50s? Because I know, late 50s, because I know from the early 50s I heard shiurim in Yiddish. Oh, wow. What you'll have. But you see, Rav Hutner, again, the Rav remained static. All right, there was a sideshow, philosophy. Rav Hutner, the main event, shifted gears over the decades. And this is an absolute fact. It's fascinating. I remember when Rav Hutner's Talmidim tried to get me interested in going to Chaim Berlin, and I remember Josh Fishman saying to me, the Maimarim are something special. No one else equals the Rosh Yeshiva on that level. And and it's true. It's true. The Mamorim, the Pachad Yitzchak, is something very special. I leave it to Alex to do a doctorate, and I'm going to give you many sources. We're far from finished.
But
what you have to do in your doctorate, see, many people question, did Rav Chutna just popularize the Maharal, or is there a new understanding that Rav Chutna added to the Maharal? That it's not just he took the Maharal and put it into Maimorim and technology and speech and thought that could relate to the 20th century. No, he did more than that. He took the Maharal and he added a new vision, a new layer, a new shtanz to it that you didn't have before. And that's an open question. And Schwarzschild wrote, people wrote, but no one has really gone into it on a definitive level. Okay, now that's one part of Rav Chutna. Then there's another part.
Okay, so he had great influence on the Aaron Lichtenstein.
We'll come to that, of course. Hold off.
I'm curious to hear about that, because it doesn't seem like Rav Lichtenstein follows that.
No, beside the relax. Then there's another part. Here you have a Talmud of Rav Kook, who was very close to Rav Kook, who had Rav Kook's picture up in his sukkah. This is well known in the early years in the United States. And as time moved on, he moved entirely away from Rav Kook, and his relationship to Rav Kook became, I just defended myself in my latest article on Meir Kahana, so Jewish Action got three letters, terrible letters. You know, again, leftists believe they have a monopoly on truth, and anyone who has a different opinion is an idiot. It's unbelievable.
Or a bigot.
A bigot, whatever, fascist. And they got three letters. How did you publish an article in Meikani? You wanted to drive all the Jews out of Israel. So Jewish Action said to me, if you wish, you can answer. If not, forget it. So Malcolm, my wife, said, don't answer. What are you going to dignify these people? But I said, no, I'm going to write a brief answer. No, I'm not going to argue with them. And I wrote a very nice little answer that my article on Mayer's latest book by Libby. First of all, that idiot says Libby's writing fairy tale. The book is totally documented. You can agree or disagree with Mayer. But I said, I make clear in the article that he was my Rebbe in Bnei Akiva, etc. But there are many things I disagree. It's not that certain things, fine, good. But within, you must work within the system, in my opinion, and I explained it in the article. So in my response now, I once again quote the example I gave in the article, which I thought people will understand how in 1972 this kid asks his Rosh Yeshiva, I've studied now enough years, I want to go into the army. And the Rosh Yeshiva tells him, the army's not for you, you're really frum, and you will not get ahead in the army because they don't want religious Jews officers in the IDF. And I said, by working within the system, look where we are today when Meir Kahana's own nephew is a brigadier general in the IDF. And it's a very, Mordechai Kahana, it's a very powerful example. So I wrote in the response now, that my attitude towards Meir is Palginin Dibura. Yeah, I quoted the Gemara, I give the source, Palgin Gemara, you know, sometimes we accept this, don't accept that, Palginin Dibura in Eidut, and many times in Shas you come up with that concept. It's a very powerful concept. This became Rav Chutna's attitude towards Rav Kook. Palginin Dibura, as far as the Maharal, the Tzidkut, the Kedusha, the Hasidut, the philosophy, he never denied Rav Kook. But when it came to the overall philosophy, you could see how step by step he moves away from Rav Kook. Give you some examples. But you don't, not that we need the examples, but when the State of Israel was declared, this became a state, an army, a police force, an air force, El Al. No? What am I missing? Remember the boat, the Shalom? The state of Israel has a boat. Oh, what went on over the boat? Should it be kosher? Shouldn't it be kosher? All right, the boat was made kosher. Big battle fought. It wasn't simple. It's not today with the population what it is today. At that time, the religious Jews in Israel, Shomer Shabbos, maybe 15%. Today, it's a different story. The boat was kosher. Ah, but then you have a problem. Shabbat, do you remember? Some of you have to remember this. It was in the 1950s. What went on? 60s, what was it? 60s already. I don't know, probably the early 60s. Oh, what went on? The battle. It's worth research. Someone should do a master's thesis on what went on with the SS Shalom and Shabbat. The boat is being run by Jews. Now, as far as I recall, Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, stepped out of it and said, leave it to the chief rabbi of Israel, whatever they decide, I will go along. But that's what I recall. Yes, do you recall the Rav's? That's what I recall. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, whose word carried tremendous weight. No, tell me why, Alex. Because he was an engineer and he specialized in navigation in boats. And the Rebbe came out and said, it's impossible. You know, they said the boat runs automatically on Shabbos. And the Rebbe said, that is impossible. That decisions have to be made. There have to be changes. You can't say a boat is going to run automatically. Today, by the way, it's probably possible. Because with computerization, if they can run a car without a driver, you probably could run a boat where the boat itself, the computer, will react with the changes in climate and sea, etc. I'm not an expert. I'm only throwing it out as a lay person who can't believe they have cars without passengers. And, tremendous machloket broke out. And Agudat Yisrael in America came out against the boat running. Jews cannot go on it because once you're on the boat on Shabbat, you're being nenef from malacha being done by Jews on Shabbat. And Rabbi Yitzchak Chutna was one of those who absolutely asked it. So you see, this already is a different viewpoint than the Zionist, than the Mizrahi, and ultimately the SS Shalom was sold. They couldn't do it. They didn't succeed financially, but in quote, in sagrayim, in parentheses, don't want the microphone to pick it up, the real reason it didn't succeed was a different reason altogether. Now you tell me, what's the difference when you fly on El Al or you fly on British Airways? You fly on British Airways, the stewardess is the steward. What can I do for you, sir? Are you comfortable? Can I bring you another drink? Let's see an Israeli Zolstein Feinem, and can I help? Let me please another drink. All right. I will admit, in a time of crisis, the Israelis are wonderful. That I have to. Al Basariya Chazana, when my grandson was wounded in battle, the stories that he came back and told about the operation and the hospital, and his stewardesses came that night. The flight was canceled. People were not flying. El Al canceled planes. Stewardesses came to the hospital to give out candy, to encourage. And my grandson asked them, "Who sent you?" They said, "No, we weren't sent. It's not that El Al sent us. We came because we wanted to." My daughter told me, one woman, he was wounded in Assa, so the operation was an hour after they got them quickly to the hospital in Be'er Sheva. And one woman is giving out food. And my daughter says to her, "What restaurant are you from?" And she says, "Restaurant? This is from my kitchen. And you don't have to worry. Ein lach malafached. Ani lo rak hasher lemahadrin glat chalak. And the love, and I mean, it's overwhelming. And the surgeon who operated on him, weeks later, my children run a shul on Rechov Palmach, and they're standing outside the shul Shabbos morning, and this tall man, not from the shul, comes over wearing a kippah. And my daughter happened to be standing there. My daughter says to him, "Efshal azol lecha?" And he says, "Kein, ani mechapes et mishpachet Ackerman." You did. And my daughter says, "Ani ima? Kan, who made sure?" He was the surgeon to operate. He wanted to find out how Yedid is doing. And he was told, "You can find the family in this shul." And he lived in Katamon. I mean, go and dream, and overwhelming. So I don't want to say one bad word about Israelis, but as far as service during a normal period, if I would tell you what I went through to find out, I need for the American government your the money you have here to get a document. It was unbelievable. So that's the real reason I'm told why the SS Shalom backed out. I'll give you another example. You all know this example, and we live with it until today. Synagogue Council of America. Just think for a moment. Now, this, by the way, is the determining moment when you see what's called the swing to the right begins in America. 1956. And you all know the story. It's been documented. I write about it. And others talk about it and write about it. And you all know the story that the Synagogue Council, comprised of Orthodox Conservative Reform synagogues, is now celebrating the new president, and he will be inaugurated in Temple Emmanuel, New York. The nohag was, when it's 1 year, 2 years Orthodox, 2 years Conservative, 2 years Reform, and the inauguration is in a shul temple in accordance with the new president's outlook, belief. So Mo Feuerstein, who was the outgoing president of the Synagogue Council, representing the OU, is now invited to Temple Emmanuel. And he asks the Rav, and then he asks the Baron Cutler, if he's allowed to participate. And of course, you all know the 11 Rosh Yeshiva issue what's popularly called the Cherem, the Iser, that you cannot have a synagogue council, cannot have a New York Board of Rabbis under no condition. How can we sit with them? Lo drachi drachai, lo machshavoteichem machshavotai. How can we sit with Reform Conservative? The one person who refused the sign of stature was Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. Although I have to say, they also asked for Blazer Silver to sign. He was the most famous Rav in America, and he refused to sign as well, because he said this whole move is to give a shtach to pierce Yeshiva University, and he doesn't want to do anything to harm Yeshiva University. So he refused to sign too. But Mori Rebbe refused to sign, and of course, Mori Rebbe was interviewed by the Mogen Journal why he refuses to sign, and Mori Rebbe came up with the concept that on matters of public interest, we must stand together as one united people. On matters of halacha, the synagogue council has veto power. Anybody can veto, meaning the Orthodox can veto something. So there's no problem. We're not going to issue statements that you can drive the shul on Shabbos. But on anti-Semitism, Zionism, economic factors, etc., politicians, that which unites us is much more than that which divides us. Now, where would Rav Kook have stood? In my humble opinion, absolutely, totally in agreement with Rav Soloveitchik. His own outlook vis-a-vis the Zionists, the workers of the land, the Chalutzim, was exactly like the Rav's thinking. No one said that Kibbutz Degania is a paragon of Shmirat Shabbat and Kashrut, but give credit for what they're doing, building the land. That itself is a great mitzvah. Rav Chutna was one of the great leaders, and I'll come and tell you a story, but not yet. One of the great leaders of the movement against synagogue council. So you can see that Rav Chutna, he moved from that relationship with Rav Kook, Palginin Dibura, the maral he took, Rav Kook's learning, philosophy, Kedusha, in many ways Rav Kook influenced him. But on a practical level, he moved into a different world, and ultimately the picture of Rav Kook came down from his sukkah. He couldn't reproduce the haskama to Torah Tanazir, because what does he do with Rav Kook's haskama? And that picture, they say, was replaced by a picture of the Satmar Rav, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum. Okay? Rabbi Yoelish. Okay? Now, with the Lubavitcher Rebbe,
here too. Relationship with Rabbi
Yoel? Yeah, well, a relationship with
the Satmar Rebbe?
We'll come to what he held from the Satmar Rav. I don't know if it was a personal relationship, but there was an admiration for the Satmar Rav, as called them, the last of the lions. We'll come to it. Relax. But there, he held from him to a great degree, which I will show you. But more than that, Baruch Atah Melech Olam Shekom Yedvarom. It's a big shiloh that I have to make a bracha, because I'm drinking to wet my vocal cords. I try to have hana. I should put Coca-Cola in. It would be easy to make a bracha. Okay. With the Lubavitcher Rebbe, here too, it's very fascinating. There was a shift. Originally, here, Chaim Berlin was in Brooklyn, not far from Crown Heights, right or wrong. They say that when the sixth Rebbe was Rebbe and his son-in-law came, Rav Chutna, who yet knew the son-in-law from Berlin, they had a weekly chavruta, they learned together. Later on, his attitude towards Lubavitch became very diffident, very hesitant. And here we have Memoir Literature, why? The messianic feeling. The sixth Rebbe, as Lubavitch started to expand, so the sixth Rebbe coined the phrase, or the slogan, Alta le Tshuva, Alta le Gula, if I'm quoting it correctly. If I'm not quoting it correctly, I'm very close to it. La alta la tshuva, la alta la gula. That's the exact quote. What does it mean? We got to do tshuva, and if we do tshuva, it'll bring about the geula. And I need not tell you, in America, when the sixth Rebbe came, we had to talk of tshuva for one simple reason. There were no from Jews in the United States. All right, there was a residue, Chaim Soloveitchik, Rupture and Reconstruction. His classic sociological study, Genius of Genius. I mean, whatever Chaim touches, you see the Soloveitchik genius. Rupture and Reconstruction, which is 20 years ago published already, Reb Chaim makes the claim, we had to start all over in America. There was no continuity, there were no from Jews here. So Professor Mark Stein or others came out against him. They wanted me to write a rebuttal as historian. The last thing in the world I want to get involved is rebutting my classmate, Reb Chaim. I got enough problems in life. Les mitzvah, leave me alone. But sure, of course there were some from people here. The Tarragons, give you one simple example. When did your family get here? Get there, I should say.
1917, 1918.
Okay, so here, his family, Rabbi Nathan Tarragon, his uncle, we in the Bronx, he was a Shem Dava. So there were some from families that got there. For my wife's family got to America in the 1870s. You have any idea? My wife has great-great-grandparents buried in Queens, in Mount Hebron Cemetery. There were a few in between families that remained from. My wife's family had Malachim. Remember my lectures on Malachim? There were Malachim in my wife's family. But Chaim essentially is right. There was a big rupture. For Chabad to begin, what are you going to begin? With the 20 Chabadnikim in America who are Shana Shabbos? You'll tell me 200. The Rebbe envisioned tens of thousands, the sixth Rebbe. America's nicht anderisch wie die alte Heim. You know what the Rebbe said when he arrived in 1940. America's not going to be any different. So you had to talk about Shiva. But Rav Hutner, and here you read the Rebbe Deutsch's work, he documents it, but it's a fact. He was very frightened that when you speak, talking about Geula, it's like right now, the Mekubalim say, Trump is a Gilgul Neshama of Koresh HaMelech. Okay? Remember what I told you, weren't here, those of you who weren't here, I told them in class yesterday, I was walking to shul yesterday morning, so I live in the same building with Dr. Sam, Professor Sam Dershowitz. So Sam and I always walk to shul together. So Sam, I tell Sam, you heard that the Mekubalim say? I said to Sam, you know something, I'm shaking. Sam, what are you talking about? I said, before the election, the Mekubalim said, beyond any doubt, Trump is going to win. I thought they were off the wall. Like a good Litvak, I laughed all the way to davening Shachris. I laughed. Trump, Clinton is in, we're going to suffer, whatever. Take a look what happened here. I said to Sam, the Mekubalim say he's Koresh? I'm shaking. Sam says, Aaron, he says, you were my last Litvisha stronghold. If you're talking like this, I'm losing my face. Period. Sam.
Alex, relax yourself.
Alex, listen carefully. There's a big fear. You don't want to get the people like the Yom Kippur War. Remember the story I told you? Rav David Chai Cohn told the students in BMT, Mashiach is coming, go Gumadol, by Pesach you'll be Geula. And they said, no, said to me, Rebbe, what do you think? I said, I hope he's right, but I don't want to be around to pick up the pieces if he's wrong, okay? So,
but, you know, the Rebbe's and Chabad never spoke like that.
Relax.
No, I'm just...
Let me tell you about Rav Hutner. We spoke about the Levant. So Rav Hutner, now there were plenty of kids in Chaim Berlin who started going to Lubavitch. You can remember Lubavitch was a magnet. The Rebbe, the two sons, and everything we described in the 40s, okay? Lubavitch was a magnet, and you got to remember that Menachem Mendel, people couldn't believe this is a young man who knew Kol HaTorah Kula on his fingertips. I mean, this you can't, it cannot be denied. The biggest Litvak cannot deny what the Rebbe knew. You know what the Rav said about him? He never met anyone with such a phenomenal memory. Quote, end quote. The Moriah Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik. So, one of the kids put up a sign in Chaim Berlin. La'alta l'tshuva, la'alta l'gula. Rav Hutner ripped it off. And he called Lubavitch and he said, one more sign like that and I'll usher any of my students going. So, he had very fascinating, over the years, there was a very warm relationship with the seventh Rebbe. They learned together. But over the years, Rav Hutner was always diffident. He was a little bit frightened of the messianic overtone. Again, you see, he shifts gears. It's not like the Rav from the day he was introduced to Lubavitch in Chaslovich as a young kid. That attitude of love, respect, understanding, to a certain degree admiration, all his life, that attitude remained constant. And you now have a whole volume came out, The Rav and the Rebbe by Chaim Dalfin, which is a fascinating read. It's not a, it's a good read. It's the footnotes. You gotta read every syllable in the footnotes. you can agree or disagree. I mean, he tries to reach a conclusion. You saw I disagreed in class. I told you, although I wrote the preface, I view the Rav as a big chocolate cake of Litvisha understanding Torah outlook. The icing was Hasidus, particularly Chabad.
Rabbi Dalfin and
Rabbi Alex view the Rav that there was more of a black and white cake mixed together with the Litvish and the Hasidish right in the cake.
I think the truth is not there.
The truth is what?
Not there. The truth is that it stayed the whole book. The whole concept of tshuva in the law is pure Talmud.
Okay, so Yitzchak agrees with Rabbi Dalfin. They're fine.
But it's just an opinion. If you studied the law's idea,
Yitzchak,
in a person that never stayed.
Did you read the book yet?
No, today.
Okay, you'll read the book.
It's the concept of tshuva.
Right, not to say, not to say.
Because you have something in the neshama that isn't tainted.
Okay, now, Yitzchak, you can agree with Rabbi Dalfin. I'm entitled to be a little bit different. I viewed it like icing on the cake.
This record that he had is the Muhammad, when he was a little boy.
Right, right. Introduced.
That was the wrong. What do you think he did on Saturday nights in Boston?
Yitzchak agrees with you. Baruch Hashem, I got to make a Shechiyanu. That Rabbi Glassman and Rabbi Rubin agree, Shechiyanu. Yitzchak, I'm well aware of that. There's a guy named Rakefet in his work on the Rav, which until now is the only work of that nature on the Rav, with all the books that came out. A new book appeared in the Rav, and I was happy to see the first footnote. You have to see the Rav, the World of, by Aaron Rakefet, and he describes the Rav in totality and honesty. Baruch Hashem.
What's the new book?
I haven't read it yet. Someone sent me a PDF of it. I don't know if it's available in stores yet. No, it's philosophical.
Oh, okay.
It deals with the Rav and his and the Last Rabbi. It's called.
William Kohlbrenner.
How do you pronounce the name? Kohlbrenner. And who is he exactly? I see he teaches in Nature, philosopher, and he describes the Rav and from what I gathered, the struggle between the heart of Volozhin and the broader aspects of the Rav. I'm looking forward, but I have to finish the volume on Russian Jewry, then I'll handle this. Okay, anyway, let me just finish up. You can argue from today to tomorrow. It's an honest argument, and maybe you're right, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm prejudiced because the heart of the Rabbi Saul was Shas and Paiskim. Everything else was a side show. But all right, you want to put the... We'll ask Ora to make two cakes, a black and white and a chocolate with a separate icing. But say that...
Harmonious relationship.
You're quoting, boy, you know my Torah inside out. Okay. Harmonious relationship. Yeah, but is it a synthesis or harmonious? But say that. Also, with the Satmar Rav, I have to say, there's no question that Rabbi Huttner was close to Rav Kook and close to the Zionist movement and close to Bnei Akiva. Over the years, he went into a total Satma position in a theological level. And that you saw, he gave a talk at the Aguda Convention. No talk would be given like that today. And it was written up and published in Jewish Observer. And I saw with my own eyes Gedolei Yisrael take that Jewish Observer, throw it on the ground, stomp on it, and spitted it. These I saw. It was exactly the Satmar's viewpoint regarding the Holocaust. I can't even repeat the theory.
What year is it?
I'll give you sources when I do, but it has to be in the 70s. Yeah, it has to be in the 70s. And the whole point of view that we didn't listen to Gedolei Yisrael and we challenged Hitler and we demonstrated and it was an entire development. Here too you see how Rav Huttner moved, shifted gears in life. And we'll see. He was asked, he defends himself. We'll get there, but it's an interesting individual. He's exactly the opposite of some other Gedolei Yisrael who remain totally constant. And this affected his private image, his public image, Chaim Berlin, his heritage. We have a lot more to go. Morty.
How do you reconcile his Satmar outlook with his love for coming back to Eretz Yisrael all the time?
You can ask the Satmar Rav, and the Satmar Rav will tell you, was tracht ihr bei mir Eretz Yisrael ist wichtig, ist teuer, das ist Eretz HaKodesh, aber die Zionim haben das Mekalkel gewonnen. Got it? That's the answer. They all loved Israel, everyone loved Israel, but the Zionim, what they did to the Kaisel, boys and girls come together there, men and women mix in the plaza outside the Kaisel, and now the Reform want to come along and have their own synagogue there, and I got to tell you, a good percentage of the people I identify with see nothing wrong with it. Wow, let everyone, I saw an article in Makari Shon, every Jew should feel welcome, and we desecrate the holiness of the culture where the whole concept of Mechitza began. You want to, what you do in your house is your business, but this is the Kotlam, it's the base of Mikdash. Wow, I told you, I never dreamt I would have a Havi Amina to vote for Degel HaTeira. or Agudat Yisrael. I never dreamt I'd have a Havimina. I told my grandchildren on that issue, they stand firm. Our people are busy with Eretz Yisrael. But this is the Enfa. I apologize to those who don't know Yiddish, but sometimes an answer has to be given in Yiddish, and I hope you got the point. My dear students, I'm only beginning. What can I tell you? I titled today's lecture Rabbi Hillel Goldberg, and I will tell my right-hand man, Reb Natan, Yutet Kislev, called the lecture Gradual Development in Rabbi Huttner's Life. Okay? Rabbi Hillel Goldberg will reach next time, and it goes for $36,000 linked to the shekel. I'm going to introduce you to something, you'll kiss your fingers. You'll see Yitzchak overwhelmed.
Actually, to sum it up, this position is a distinction is made between Kedusha Eretz Israel and Medina Israel.
Yes, you know that.
The Kedusha is there.
Right, the Kedusha is there. Well,
act of Satan.
The Satmar Rav didn't rip Lech Lecha out of his Chumash yet. You follow me? That's the way you have to view it.
If you think about it, one of the greatest achievements in Yehudus was that we undid the concept of Satan as an important part of religion. And along come the Satmar people and brought him back. After 2,000 years.
I don't think...
The Masavuta Acher. Okay, let it stand.
Let it stand.
Let me summarize. So what we did today, we went further. In other words, I told you with Rav Huttner, I began with a simple biography, and now I'm going into the biography, and I'm going deeper and deeper and deeper into each level. What I'm saying is not my own thought, basically. I didn't know Rav Huttner intimately. I will later, you'll see when I'm going to come back and do everything again and again and give you all the sources and put it all together. I come back to what I said a week ago in my introductory remarks, that it's really a shame that Art Scroll does not have a proper biography of Rav Huttner. But you see, there's a big problem. Art Scroll can do biographies if Gedolei Yisrael are born with kippah on their heads, and at the age of two, they're making a bracha. There's one story with a kid milking from his mother, nursing him from his mother, and he's asking what they asked to make a bracha before he... I mean, I couldn't believe my eyes, but to me, the beauty of Torah is, and we'll come to this in Rav Huttner, is the struggle, how the Rav became the Rav, how the Rebbe became the Rebbe, how Rav Moshe became Rav Moshe. Have you ever thought for a minute, Rav Moshe, communist, you know what it meant to live under the communist? comes to America in 1937, think what these people went through and look what came out of them, all right? And in my own life, you know, I wasn't born sitting behind this desk. I came to Israel unwanted, uncalled, unsought, no one to talk to. Who was I to talk? I told you, 69, I went to Merkaz Harav, they cursed that Hebrew U. I went to Hebron Yeshiva. Oh, I can't even repeat what I heard there. I walked away. I said, boy, I don't belong there, you know? And take a look what's happened here in Israel. But just think of the struggle. But Baruch Hashem. We live to see the Israeli army rescind the beard order. You're aware of that, idiots. I write about that in Jewish Action, where I'm at the gentilized Israeli. Remember what I wrote in Jewish Action now? America Hana, you want Haredim in the army, and you're ushering beards. So Baruch Hashem, they just rescinded the order 2 weeks ago. Now, I want to make some announcements. Shvut Ami is running a campaign this Wednesday to raise $100,000 in 24 hours. Shvut Ami, what we're doing in Russia, you have to see it to believe it. I may be leading a group of people to Russia at the end of May. They're trying to work it out. We'll see what happens. We have 72, 74 shlichim in Russia. Many cannot, people don't want to go back to Russia full time. So we worked out an idea. It's working very successfully. 2 weeks in Russia, back here, and a month and a half later, you go back for another 2 weeks. And you have people in Russia, what you lecture on and all, they then spend time with the students elaborating. They want to raise $100,000 in 24 hours. Anyone who wants to contribute, if you give a dollar, Shvut Ami gets $4. Three families have undertaken to match dollar for dollar, any dollar that comes in. Shvut Ami is tax exempt anywhere in the world, America, Canada, England, Israel, Russia. If you have rubles, it's tax exempt too. The American person to contact is David Kofnis. His phone number is 201-575-9080. David Kofnis, Rabbi David Kofnis, 201-575-9080. I also want to mention that next week there is no class. It is Hanukkah. We pick up 2 weeks from now. And the Sunday class is not disturbed again. The Monday class is not disturbed. The week afterwards is Aser B'Teva. It falls on a Sunday. Obviously, there's no class. My Talmud, Rabbi Micha Berger, who's dresses like a chassid. I wonder if he's chassidish or the Bekish is just to kind the words of the Rambam that you have to dress differently on Shabbat. Great individual. So Micha wrote to me, I have a lot of nachat, that my Talmud, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, I have two copies here. Remember I say all along in Shia that Chabad solved the feminist problem. There's no problem there with female rabbi shluchat. Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg went to a Chabad, a conference of women, and he was blown away by the capability and how happy they are to be shluchat. No one is innovating there. The Rebbe totally solved the problem. Here's a beautiful article, and Rabbi Questel, the Mashpia who died from Morristown, a very inspiring individual. And these are all articles, believe it or not, that came in on the Katzenellenbogen family, so that there's a world of material to enjoy. If anyone wants the article on the Mansur, the article on the water, which is overwhelming. And I want to wish everyone a Chag Urim Sameach. I'll give you one quick vort that I've said many times. It's from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and it actually happened. In the mid-50s, the word was going out, great things are happening in Crown Heights. So we kids in YU, MTA at the time, we wanted to go to Crown Heights. We arranged to go to Crown Heights for Shabbos. A whole little group of kids from MTA. I was in Rabbi Noach Bornstein Shir. So it was my senior year in high school. And we went Shabbos, and it was right before Yud Tet Kislev, Shabbos Mevorchim. And the Rebbe evidently was told, I mean, the Chassid would say that the Rebbe looked at us and knew where we were from. The Rebbe was evidently told by, let's say, Rebbe Leibel Grona, that there's a group of wise guys here from Yeshivas Kibbutz Chochanan. So the Rebbe said, I'm saying it in English, I heard it in Yiddish, the Rebbe said, thank God the Maccabim were Chassidim. If they would have been Litvakin, there would have never been a holiday of Hanukkah. Why? You come to, you know, the Gemara in Bamei Matlikin, you come to the Beis HaMikdash, you find one cruse of oil that has the seal that's not defiled. No, you make the cheshbon. I have one cruse of oil. If I light the menorah, the halacha is the menorah has to be constant and can't go out. It's going to take another week to get kosher oil from the Galil. Like the Ran explains, it takes 3 days to get there. Shabbos, you can't travel. 3 days to get back. How can you light the menorah? It will not be constant. Onus Rachmana Patre. Let's wait 7 days, and then when we know we'll have the proper oil a day from now, we'll start with the first cruise. That's the way a Litvak would have acted. But a Chassid came, the Maccabim came, they found one cruise of oil. Yeah, Mimakdala, we make all the cheshbonis you make, it doesn't make sense. Onus Rachmana Patre. But mitzvah habali yotcha al tachmitzena. We have to do what we have to do. And the rest is up to the Ribbono Shel Olam. They lit the first candle and look at the miracle that happened. And this is why we have Hanukkah. And let me tell you, I heard a lot of different Torah in my life from Gedolei Yisrael. But that fell from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Emet V'Yatziv, until today. I live that way, act that way, am inspired that way, answer questions that way. Thank God the Maccabim were Chassidim. Yutet Kislev Ufaratzta. Until we meet again, Afreilich and Chanuk Hagorim Smeich, when we get in health and happiness to all my Talmidim in front of me and all those listening across the wide expanse of the Jewish universe. Das Vidanya. Thank you very, very much. Gary, thank you for coming. Are you back again, or this is just visiting?